What age should a child be ready to get a cell phone?
Best answer I've ever heard to that question is, when are you ready for your kid to start watching porn? Because that's the first thing they're going to do.
Today's guest is Dr. Jared Cooney Horvath. He's a neuroscientist who studies how the brain learns, remembers, and changes. But this isn't really a conversation about education. It's a conversation about childhood, parenting, technology, attention, and what happens to a society when we misunderstand how the brain actually works.
Yeah.
Jared, where you work in Portland currently?
I'm Portland, Oregon now, yep.
What kind of things are we getting wrong about education?
Oh, goodness. I'd say the ultimate thing we've gotten wrong is the narrative right now is that education is broken. And that's, I blame TED Talks for that. That's been perpetuated for like the last 15 years. Education's broken. Yeah, it's killing creativity. By what metric could anyone have possibly said that education was broken? If you go back, 2010 was basically the golden age of education globally. Scores had never been higher. More kids had access to it. More kids were succeeding through it. Well-being measures were through the roof. We were focused more on holistic learning than ever before. But I guess somebody needed to sell a product, so they invented a story that education's broken, and ever since then, we've kind of gone downhill from there. So all the moves, I'd say, since 2010 that education has taken is kind of following a bad path that's taking us away from effective learning to something else.
What are we doing to children today that history is going to judge us for?
Shoving a screen in front of their face for 6 hours a day and saying, why are you so weird as an adult now? I mean, that's what, like, Gen Z, if you track Gen Z, our generation, I'm going to go back. I'm early millennial, late Gen X. We had technology in our life and in our schools, but it was always very peripheral. Like, we had a computer lab at school.
Now it's a babysitter.
Exactly. Now you can't get rid of this stuff. And that's in, there was a time when at least you could say at home parents were using tech, but at school you'd get your reprieve. But now, over half of our kids are using a screen up to 4 hours a day every single day at school. And they're growing up. Gen Z is now, their memory is lower than ours ever has been. Attention is lower. General IQ is lower. Creativity is, everything's lower. And we're shocked. We're like, what's wrong with this generation? We did that to them. It's not their fault. They're not weird or different. We built a world that forced them to grow in a way that now we're saying, why'd you grow like that? Our fault.
What's the most important thing a parent can do in the first 5 years of a child's life?
During that stage, it's exposure, exposure, exposure. So the brain is in a very unique state during those first 5 years of life where basically it's doing what we call refining. It's taking all the input it can and it's tweaking itself to match your context. That's why if you have a baby, raise them in the US, they'll learn English. That same baby raised in Japan will learn Japanese. It's just refining. So the more input they get in those first 5 years, it's always going to be a good thing. So expose them to more words, more languages, more songs, more colors, more experiences. Do a slide, do a swing as much as you can. It's going to be good.
What shapes a child more, parents, peers, school, or technology?
It's going to depend on age. If you have to say overall lifespan, parents. The biggest influence on our development is the 9 months that we're in the womb, and that's all controlled by our parents. So if you just want to go holistically, parents. Really though, around age 5 into 6, 7, that's when peers and media start to really take over. And during adolescence, it's basically all peers and media at that point. And that's why a lot of research says parents have no influence on teenagers. Yeah, there's a reason your teenager speaks English instead of Japanese if you're in the U.S. That's the influence you had on them. So we definitely do. It just starts to shift their personality to favor outside voices than inside.
But I see parents of young kids now just putting an iPad in front of their face and letting them go.
And isn't that, and I get it. Look, I'm a parent. I get it. It's, you don't want your kid to flip out. Sometimes you got to focus on something else and it works. If you put a screen in front of a kid, they're gone. The problem is a lot of what we learn comes in those interstitial moments where we're screwing up. So let's say you have a kid who always acts up at a restaurant. We are not born to know how to act in a restaurant. So the only way we're ever going to learn is to fail at it, is to cry and scream, and then dad picks you up and walks you outside, and then you don't get dinner that night. And the next time you try a little bit better. You have to experience the world in order to learn how to live in it. But if every time I've ever been in a restaurant, the screen pops out, You can't be shocked when you now have a teenager who cannot sit at a restaurant without a screen. They don't know how to interact. It's because we have to experience the world, and the screen just basically cuts off most of that experience.
We've all, especially people like basically younger than my generation, maybe a little bit, a decade or two younger than mine. We're all addicted to these devices.
Yeah, well, it's hilarious. Adults. So there was a new study just came out that adults check their phone on average once every 4.5 minutes now. That's an adult. That's people with fully functioning brains, fully connected wiring.
Grew up without the cell phone.
And we are as addicted to it as the next person. And now we give that to a kid who hasn't developed a brain yet, hasn't even developed really a personality, and we assume it's going to be some inert neutral tool, just something to keep them busy. No, we can't be shocked when they become addicted to it more than us and when it gears their development in a way we didn't expect it to. It's not neutral. It's not just a timeout for an hour. That is part of their development.
Yeah, I've had dinners with my daughters. I have two daughters in their young 20s. And my oldest daughter said, let's just not use cell phones tonight at dinner.
Yeah.
And it's like, it was so refreshing and different.
Oh, isn't that
really
nice?
Unusual. And it's like, shit, we used to do this every single meal.
We didn't have a choice.
It's either each other
or no one. Yeah. So isn't that funny? What we're starting to see, and I like this, is Gen Z is starting to push back a bit.
Mm-hmm.
They're starting to say, wait, we don't like this. Why did you do this to us? And Gen Alpha, the younger kids, are even starting to push back more. Like, I was just in a third grade classroom, and we were talking about AI and how stupid that is. And one of the kids said, AI is a boomer's tool. We don't use that. And I'm like, all right, cool. If that's what you think, good. It shows you're moving in the right direction.
Yeah, there could be a backlash against, a reaction against all AI and all that.
Oh, I hope so. My hope is that AI was the step too far. Like, tech has just been infiltrating, and people are just letting it. Get into this bit of our life. Get into this bit of our life. Then AI hits, and I think that's the one that woke everyone up and said, what are you guys doing with these data centers, with this tool, replacing input? What are you up to? And so hopefully that is the straw that just breaks big tech back.
One thing I've always thought, and I've mentioned it in a couple of videos in the last 7 years here, is that like for everything that happens, it's a law of the universe. Everything that happens good, there are bad aspects to that. And everything that happens that's bad, there are good aspects to it. And it's almost universal. Everything that good leads to something bad and vice versa. There are qualities about both. And so with technology, we all see it as this wonderful thing that's made our lives better and easier and faster and quicker. And it's like, it's just, we made us all smarter and whatever. But there are negative aspects to that. And you never hear people really talk about that.
No.
But there's got to be some super significant negative aspects to technology.
Who leads that conversation is the people who benefit from tech, the tech people. So they'll never bring up the bad stuff. And anyone who does bring up something bad, tech has enough money and power to say, shut up. And we shut up.
Yeah.
But you're right. Like, think about speed, okay? Speed, efficiency, efficacy, sweet, wonderful. These are all terms that matter in the workforce when we're producing something. Speed, efficacy, efficiency, these are not words that align with learning. Speed has never been a defining characteristic of effective learning. Yet when we bring the tools that were built maybe for the workplace to help experts do their job easier into the classroom with novices who are just learning how to navigate the world, you're going to get a really different outcome with them. And that's the best. It doesn't make you smarter. It makes you weaker. It doesn't make you sharper. It makes you more dependent on tools rather than your own internal abilities. So I think the bad, what's the term? Luddites, right? So I don't want to bore anyone, but it's a great story. So the Luddites, they're the old cloth weavers. During the Industrial Revolution, they invent the power looms. So what do these weavers do? They go and they just start breaking the power looms. They start crashing things. They say, no, not in our world. You're going to kill our profession. You're going to kill our culture. And now they make fun of the Luddites. Like, if you are called a Luddite, that means you just hate tech. You're a backwards peasant. You don't know anything. No, you forget the Luddites weren't fighting against technology. They used technology. They were fighting for a way of life that they valued. They reckoned that these tools were going to lessen what it meant to be human, and they didn't want that. So I call myself a Luddite. I think it's the new Luddite movement when we start to say, no, I'm not fighting against tech. I'm fighting for a way of life that we are losing because we haven't reckoned with the ultimate cost of what these new technologies do.
Yeah, there's going to be a serious price to having these cell phones that do everything for us, or AI, which is going to make everything easier and faster and quick. It's like, it's going to make us all seem smarter. But like, there's, and we're starting to see signs of it now, like with, like kids in their 20s and or so. They're like nobody's dating. Nobody's got – no one's having kids.
Mm-hmm.
I'm exaggerating, of course. But it's like it just seems like the number – the marriages, kids, all that kind of stuff, relationships even. Last year, the Palisades fire tore through Los Angeles. Most people saw that story. What fewer people saw is that 2026 is shaping up to be the worst wildfire year on record globally. The total area burned worldwide is already more than 20% higher than any year since 2012. That story is out there. It's just being told differently depending on where you look. Left-leaning outlets are focused on the U.S. response, what the government is doing, and who's affected locally. Right-leaning outlets are covering the global scale, the scope, the numbers, what's happening in other countries. It's the same crisis, but with two completely different lenses. Neither version is lying. But if you're only reading sources on one side, you're only getting half the picture. That's something I think a lot about doing what I do. The people I sit down with, their stories get filtered the same way, shaped by who's telling it and who they're telling it to. That's why I use Ground News. It's an app that shows you how any story is being covered across the political spectrum, side by side. You can see each outlet's bias, how reliable they are, and who owns them. You can actually compare instead of just getting handed one version of the news. Check it out at ground.news/SWU. You'll get 40% off their Vantage plan. And by subscribing or gifting it, you're directly supporting this channel too. That's ground.news/SWU. Now back to the video.
This is what happens when you're in a hyper-individualized, hyper-personalized world, right? So what is the great Western experiment? Is the individual matters. And I love it. Absolutely. That's what makes America great, is it's not just a collective. It's also the individual rights are the ones we are fighting to protect. The problem is when that pendulum swings so far towards the individual that the collective now no longer exists. And that's what tech has done. Everyone has their own personal stream. They get their own personal feeds. They get their own lesson plans. Six kids in a room are going to learn six different things because tech is going to gear towards them. When that starts to happen, that hyper-individualization, we lose connection. And all of a sudden, we cannot interact with other people. We struggle to date because we don't even know how to have conversations unless it's directly through our feed. We've never experienced anything outside of that. Why would the family unit matter when I have all my needs, quote unquote, fulfilled by this piece of technology? Without recognizing you're not having any needs fulfilled by that technology. You're simply just amusing yourself to death. Neil Postman, that's all you're doing. Remember, so Neil Postman's big thesis, and it was spot on, was everyone is so worried about 1984. That Big Brother is going to spy on us and burn our books and change our language. And he said, but underneath 1984, published right around the same time, was Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. And he said that was correct. Aldous Huxley says they don't have to burn our books. All they're going to do is amuse us to death to the point where we don't want to read books anymore.
This has happened.
So long as we're entertained, we are just giving away our humanity left and right, and we're letting that happen. And that's the hyper-individualization. So long as I'm smiling and get the next dopamine hit, I don't need a kid. I don't need a wife. I don't need responsibility. I just need the next smile.
Yeah. When a parent asks you, when is my child ready for a smartphone? What's your answer?
That's what's best example of that, or best answer to that I've ever heard was, when are you ready for your kid to start watching porn? That is the answer. When kids get access to internet technology, the first thing they're going to do is start looking up pornography. So some parents are like, cool, that's all right with me, but other parents, not so much. it's not something for my elementary schooler to be doing.
What's the biggest mistake parents are making today, you think?
First and foremost, look, we're trying our best. We're doing what we can, not knocking parents.
I think the cost of living is just becoming more difficult to survive and thrive.
Exactly.
So people are working harder, working longer.
And we're in so doing, that takes away time.
Spending less time with their kids.
That's it. Time is a zero-sum game. When you devote an hour to one thing, that is an hour you can never devote to something else. And as the world is progressing, most of us have more than one job now. And we are just gaming across as much as we can, which is necessarily taking us away from our kids, which is then allowing them to be raised by something else. So I can't call it a mistake. I can just call it a problem that we are all experiencing right now, is we are just not having enough time with our kids to actually raise them. You know, and I can think of something else too. This is good. So there's a woman named Abigail Schreier. Did you ever, you probably have heard of John Haidt Anxious Generation. Mm-hmm. Wonderful book. Right around the same time that came out, Abigail Schreier released a book called Bad Therapy. And her argument was brilliant, I think. She said, parents today, we look back at our parents and we are so certain we don't want to be like them that we have looked elsewhere for parenting advice. We've started asking psychologists, how do I parent best? What's the best way not to screw up my kid? The problem is, psychologists, by their definition, everything has to be a problem. They are a medical profession. Ergo, if there's an issue, it must be a medical issue. So this is where now we reach where parents are so afraid to just be a parent that they assume any problem is a trauma. If my kid's pet dies, that's a trauma that requires some sort of therapy or treatment. My kid's best friend moves, that's traumatic to them. We need to protect them against that. Without realizing, no, those aren't trauma. Those aren't problems. Those are life experiences everyone has ever. If you've ever had a pet, that pet has died, 100% guaranteed. That's what life is. But we're starting to treat normal life as psychological maladies, as problems. And we're starting to over-pathologize our children.
Making a bunch of snowflakes.
Yeah. And that's what it's scary, but that's exactly how we get there, is when we're too afraid to let them experience life and to trust ourselves as parents to say, look, I don't need a therapist to help me raise a kid. I just need to call my mom sometimes and say, what do you do when your kid acts like this? What did you do when I did that? Oh, okay, I'm gonna try that. That's the advice we need. It's more realistic, it's more grounded, and that's gonna help our kids actually experience life.
Are parents overprotecting children while underprotecting their minds?
That is a very, yes. That is a very interesting idea, is we are doing everything we can to protect them in the real world while then unleashing the digital world of just nuttiness directly into their brain. And we never stop to protect that. I mean, think of how many laws are on the books for seatbelts and food and child seats, and how few laws there exist for child safety online. Basically, all we have now is, are you over 18? Click yes. Okay, come on in. And so by all means, we're making sure there. One of my favorite statistics is, since we've been recording kind of data in emergency rooms, there's this one category, which is basically incidental injury. It's not a car wreck. It's not an illness. You broke your arm. Sorry. Forever, the people who top out on incidental injury are teenage boys. They've always got more injuries than everyone else. Today, the top score in incidental injuries are 40 to 50-year-old men. It's us. Why? Now, when I first heard that, I thought, what are we doing that we're getting hurt so much? No, it turns out we're getting hurt the same. We haven't changed. It's 18-year-old boys are not getting hurt anymore. They have dropped below us. They've just stopped getting injured. Now, why? Because how are they getting injured? Climbing trees, playing football, going outside, kicking a ball, doing something stupid. When we stop them from doing that, they may not get injured, but they're going to fill that time with something. So what do? Log on in video game. And that's where they meet male influencers. That's where they start looking at porn. That's where they figure out the black market. Is that better than this? I mean, I'm not saying your kid should break their arm, but if you give me a choice between a cast and 2 hours on the internet, break your arm.
What's something that parents ignore that neuroscience says matters enormously?
Human connection. Human beings, we have evolved 150,000 years to resonate with each other. And that's what makes humans humans. That's our superpower, is other animals can imitate each other and learn through that. We simply connect, and our biologies, without us doing anything, will start to sync up. I will learn from you simply by the fact that you are another human being, whether I want to or not. So we call it, psychological term is affective empathy. The neurological process is called neurological synchrony. That syncing requires interaction. Anytime you introduce a screen between two people, or you move that interaction onto a screen, that synchrony by and large either disappears or dies. And if that's how we've evolved to grow and become the strongest animals in the world, because we can quickly learn from each other without having to experience things, and now we're just subverting that entire process, it feels like we're going against our nature by not spending more time together and forcing people to be people with each other.
Are smartphones changing children's brains or just changing their habits?
It was one and the same. The interesting thing about the brain is it always changes. If you blink, your brain changes. If you breathe, your brain changes. That's how it works. The moment your brain stops changing, you're dead. So when people say, is something changing your brain? The answer is always 100% yes, which doesn't make it an argument for or against anything. The true argument then becomes psychological. Do those changes manifest in better behaviors? And the answer here is absolutely not. Those changes are manifesting in habitual addictive behaviors, which are not good for anyone, let alone young kids. They're manifesting in more loneliness and sense of isolation. So kids, even though technically they're more connected than ever before on their phone, they are lonelier than ever before. And that's the resonance thing. How do you fight loneliness as you resonate with another human being? What do kids do? I feel lonely. I'm going to reach out on my phone. Can't do it.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, all of the changes being wrought are having very weird behavioral outcomes that I mean, far be it for me to be the judge of all this, but I don't think that's the right way to go.
It would be really interesting to see like everyone take a week off of their cell phone every other week.
And watch what starts to happen. Did you ever read, there's a book called Stolen Focus by Johan Hari. Did you read that?
No.
Basically, that was it. So he was reading all about tech and stuff. So his book is, I think it was a month off of tech just to see what would happen. And the book is that story aligned with details and data and stuff. And he's like, it's incredible. He said, after about a week, he said, songs from my childhood started to circle in my brain that I hadn't thought of in years. I was forced to actually look at people in a restaurant and realize, yeah, it's kind of scary, but it's okay. I'm not going to die from this. So just a great example of, yeah, if we could just pull it back. I mean, here's a stat, right? Smartphones in schools. We're having the debate. Do we ban them? Do we not? Of course you do. Like, why would anyone need a... So I've never heard an argument why a kid would need a phone in a school. Oh, my parents need to get a hold of me. There's a phone at the front office, mate. What do you need? Anyway, I've been around education for a long time, and this debate's been going on for a while. I know dozens of schools that have introduced phone policies where they're like, okay, kids, you can use it at recess but not during class, or in between classes but not during math, whatever. A lot of those go back. After a couple weeks, a couple months, like, this isn't really working, don't worry about it, go back. Meanwhile, I know of dozens of schools that have banned phones. We don't want to see them, they're gone, they're not on campus. Not a single one of them have I ever seen go back. As soon as phones are gone, every school goes, oh, well, look at this. Kids are playing again. They're talking on the cafeteria. They're not interrupting class 24/7. This is great. That kind of stat is it, is when you get rid of the tech, nobody thinks this is a worse life. Everyone to a man says this is better than what we were doing before. And that's the big trick. It's not as immediately fulfilling or gratifying. You don't get that dopamine hit.
It feels like boredom. But is boredom actually necessary for human brain development?
If you think of what we call higher order thinking skills, this is things like creativity and critical thinking. The vast majority of that happens when you stop paying attention, when you are bored. So believe it or not, creativity, the way creativity basically works is you pick a problem and you focus on it and you're trying to rearrange your thinking, you're trying to address it. After 2 or 3 hours, you're done. You got to take a walk. I got to go get some lunch. I'm out of here. When you step away, your biology gets to work completely subconsciously with no input from you. Your brain is now going to start to mix and match memories you forgot you even had. And it's going to say, by the way, this kind of addresses what you were talking about. This kind of solves that problem, right? Then you're going to get what are called moments of insight where you're just kind of doing the dishes and you go, oh, I got an idea. Let's write that down. Boom. And you're back to it. All of that incubation period happens when you're bored. If you don't give your biology a chance to stop and relax, you do not consolidate memories, you do not generate creative ideas, you do not have critical original thoughts, the whole system starts to crash. So when do we get that kind of boredom? In schools, it was always between classes. It was at recess. You're done with math, you got a 5-minute window till English starts. Kick a ball, go punch someone in the hallway, go have some fun, do whatever you're gonna do. That's all downtime. If now you immediately get on your phone, phones are high cognitive. They're not downtime. You're never bored. Your brain can never get into that mode where it incubates and actually starts to ideate without you. So you actually are, by all means, you're killing. Boredom is not cute. It is essential to development and thinking. And anytime you access your phone, you are killing your ability to get into that state.
Mm. So has technology made us smarter or simply just more informed?
I would say neither to both of those. It is most certainly not made us smarter by any measure we've seen, and not more informed. In order to be informed, you need to internalize knowledge in a way where your body can use it. What we are now calling informed is simply access to information. We have the ability to see it, mm-hmm. but access to information has never been enough for human biology to make any moves whatsoever. This is why you could scroll for an hour online and get as much information in that hour as you got in a year at school, leave and not remember a damn thing you just did. So you're not informed, you have access to information, but if you want to be informed, biology requires you internalize it. Otherwise, it can't conceptualize it, it can't do anything with it. So the access to information argument is actually a very good argument why we shouldn't employ tech, because it makes us think, it gives us the feeling of depth and wisdom and knowledge while cutting off depth and knowledge and wisdom right at the heels. You can't get it with that.
So if you look over the centuries and decades that we've just passed, I'm sure intelligence has always increased until yeah. something else is probably going on now, right?
So if you look at general IQ, that's our ability to measure intelligence. Take it or leave it, we can have a whole debate about that. But yes, since we've been measuring IQ, every generation has gained about 6 points on their parents. The reason for that has always been school. Is if you think about it, intelligence is cultivated in education. If every generation spends more time in school than their parents, which we always have, ergo our education, our intelligence, our IQ is going to go up. Till now. Now Gen Z, the whole thing is flipped. And even though they spend more time in school than we do, their intelligence, their IQ is going down. They are less literate than we are. They have less visual memory than we do, less auditory memory. Everything's going down. So our biggest question was why? If for a century school and IQ were running parallel, how did they suddenly decouple? Where now school can keep going up, but now intelligence is going to go down. And the only thing we keep coming back to is it's the tools we're using in school. It's the technology.
It doesn't, I mean, just like to me, you see there are certain people maybe from low, you know, from poverty-stricken neighborhoods, you see the way these people communicate and how they interact.
Yeah.
Their ability to understand just simple grammar and how to write a letter, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you use chat, boom, all of a sudden you have a perfectly written letter that you can look as professional as anyone in the world. People would absorb some of that information and change the way we speak, change the way we communicate. No?
That has always been the biggest dream, is that the more you experience this, the more you will absorb it. It will, through osmosis, you will learn how to do things better. It's a process called offloading, or in this case, outsourcing. So think about it like this. Quick story. My sister-in-law? My wife's sister is fit. She's like one of those gym rats. She's always working out. Her husband is not. That dude is slightly large. Walking to the fridge is enough for him. Anyway, they decide to rent those e-bikes, those bikes with the motors, to go to around Melbourne. So they're doing their thing. And of course, as always happens, the e-bikes run out of batteries. In her case, it doesn't matter. All she did was pedal home because she had enough underlying foundational fitness to be like, this is fine. Him, on the other hand, dude had to call an Uber to get home. Couldn't quite figure out what else to do. So he relied on another tool. So this is the offloading outsourcing argument. As experts, we can use tools to make our lives easier. And we call that offloading. So I know how to do statistics. I can use a computer to do stats for me because it'll take me 2 hours, but it'll only take that 2 seconds. Let's do it. The trick is the only reason it works is because I have enough background knowledge to immediately vet the output. When it gives me a number, I can immediately go, yep, that's right, or no, that's wrong. What did I type in? It's my expertise that allows that tool to actually function. When a novice uses that tool, we don't call it offloading, we call it outsourcing. They let the tool do everything. And because they have no base knowledge of what's right, what's wrong, the best they can ever do is copy it, paste it, thumbs up. They will have learned nothing by that process. They didn't know what happened, why it happened, whether it was right, whether it was wrong. They just copy, paste, off they go. So that's the problem, is when we offload as adults, it makes life easier, makes production better in the workforce. When we use that same skill or ability in kids, they're outsourcing, they stop learning, they don't develop.
Yeah, so that's what you're saying. So AI remembers everything for us and we end up
And then what's the point?
Nothing.
And I mean, that's a great example. I was talking about that this morning is people were saying that tech kills our memory. It doesn't really kill our memory. I mean, we have the same memory we've always had. It just redirects how we use it. So the example I always use is, what was your best friend's phone number growing up? 740-7857. I haven't dialed that in 35 years, but it's there. What's your best friend's phone number today? Hell if I know. I don't know what it is, but I do know where to find it. So that means I have built a memory for where it is located rather than a memory for what it is. So we are still using our memory. We're just gearing it towards locations and access rather than the material itself. Now you tell me, what do you think is going to be better for innovation and development and successful living in this world? Knowing where stuff is or knowing what stuff is. And that's why knowledge becomes so damn important. Any kid can point to a folder on a desktop and say, yeah, there's paper in there. What does that paper say? Well, I'd much rather you know what that paper says and not know how to find it, because then it's internalized. You take it with you wherever you go. Now you know the stuff, not just how to access it.
Interesting. What skills become more valuable in this AI world?
I think every skill we've had up until now is only more valuable. I am one of the few people who don't think AI changes a damn thing. I think AI is the most hyped up, overwrought. I 2 years ago when it first came out, everyone said, what does this change about education? I said, nothing. Because why? Let's say a kid uses AI to write an essay in school. Well, good. I spend at least an hour a day, 5 days a week with that kid. I know when that kid lies because I have a relationship with that kid. That's why it's real hard for them to fool me with AI because, sorry, kid, I've spent the last 2 months with you. I know you didn't write this.
Right.
I've spoken with you. I know how you think. That ain't you. So it's always just a futz to me. But if you want to go into the workforce, people say AI will take over jobs. It won't. It's way too expensive. It's way too silly. It's never going to do all that stuff. I mean, the return on investment is nothing at this stage. So here you go. Here's billions of dollars for nothing.
You're not worried about AI?
No. I think what's going to happen in the long run is people are going to say that was a big stupid mistake. It'll be very useful in very specific contexts if driven by an expert. So now more than ever, expertise will matter. So like think about coding, right? Anyone could vibe code and use a thing to create something, but anything that's vibe coded sucks. Ask any coder and they look at the code, they go, this thing is just hanging together by a thread, man. This is trash. They now need to fix it. And the time it takes them to fix it is usually more work than if they would have just written it from scratch. So I think what you're going to find is these very small pockets where people say AI is good here, so long as an expert is driving the AI and using it as an offloading tool rather than an outsourcing tool. So people think AI will replace workers. No, it will make the expert workers that much more valuable because to me, it's offloading. I already know the answer. I just don't feel like spending 2 hours to do it. But I can vet the output immediately and make it better, as opposed to novices who are just pressing buttons, then you're stuck with whatever AI does. I am not an AI doomer at all. No.
That's interesting to hear. Is intelligence more inherited or built?
It depends on the way you try and measure it. You've probably heard that IQ is heritable, is highly heritable. But heritability doesn't mean inherited. Its heritability is just a variation measure at a population level. It says nothing about the actual trait or the person. So I ran a study recently where I looked at, we only have data for 91 identical twins separated at birth. So for as much as people use separated twins at birth as like the marker for genes and environment, there's data for 91 of them. That's it. And I got the data for all of them. And what I did was I aligned them according to how similar their schooling was. Did the twins experience the same type and years and number of years of schooling? Did they get more different? Did they get different countries, different systems? And the more similar their education was, the more similar their IQ was, to the point where some separated twins had an IQ of 1 point difference. But the more different their education became, the more their IQ difference blew up to the point where there were a couple with IQ differences of 27. So it was like, okay, so these people have the exact same genes. They just went to different schooling systems and they came out with huge differences in IQ.
That would be so interesting to see two twins, pretty much identical twins who are vastly different in intelligence.
And that's it. So if you want to look, there's, I think one of them passed recently, but Herta and Berta the best names in the world. So Herta and Berta were born. At 4 years old, they were separated because their dad sold Berta to pay off work debts. So that, I know, that happened. That was a real thing. Berta was then raised nomadically across Scandinavia, and she only had 4 years of school. Herta was raised in one Central American village. She went to 14 years of school. They differ by 21 IQ points.
Mm.
And I there are interviews with them where you see just how vastly different they are. So I'm the king of look. When we ask the question nature versus nurture, it's a dead question. We now say nature via nurture. You cannot separate the two. But genetics aren't as deterministic as people once thought they were. A gene basically just says you're alive. Now what are you going to do with that? That matters. So I might not be able to play with your genes, but I can certainly play with your environment, and that's going to drive your outcome. So give me environment 10 days out of 10.
What do you think of homeschooling?
I've got no inherent problem with homeschooling. The thing to remember with homeschool is, one, don't make it digital, make it human. If you just keep your kid home and put him on a screen to do training online, it's not worth your time. Send them to school. Two, try and build connections between schools. The biggest problem we've seen with homeschooling is socialization, of course, is the kids just when they go to college and they don't know how to act around other kids. So if you can find 10 other people doing homeschool, get your kids together every once in a while. Get them interacting. And the third thing then to focus on, and this is more an academic term, but it's transfer, is we focus a lot on learning stuff. But one of the things schools do so damn well is how do you apply that stuff and move it across contexts? We don't just learn something and answer a question about it. We write essays about it. We do poster boards. We do presentations. All of that is helping you move that knowledge. At home, during homeschooling, we tend to leave it with, you know it. You read it. You could discuss it. Cool. And we need to remember, no, keep bringing it online. Take them to a museum and force them to use that idea over here. Take them to a park and see if they can apply that theory to, I don't know, the shadow of a flagpole or something like that. So always be thinking about transfer if you're going to do homeschool.
What was the original purpose of public education?
To build a republic, to build a society.
But wasn't it kind of like designed to produce just like workers?
It's the most bullshit thing ever said. No.
Really?
No, not at all.
I've heard that.
That's called the Prussian factory model of education, and it's nonsense. The Prussians were the first to develop a very standardized, systematized school, but they weren't building soldiers. That's what they said. They were trying to build workers and soldiers. No. They were trying to build a republic. They were trying to build a society of informed voters. That was their plan all along. And that was what the U.S. did. That's why we copied it. Thomas Jefferson, the father of public education in the U.S., said, public education is the cornerstone in our new nation. That's it. And the goal is to help build an informed public that can then push society forward. And I think one of the biggest mistakes we've made is currently, we've mistaken school as existing to serve a society. We're asking society, what does it need now? You need better work? We'll do that. You need more digital literacy? We'll try and do that. You need this? School was never meant to serve a society. It was meant to build a society. We are meant to, in public education, have huge walls up between us and the world so we can focus on issues that we care about and then pump out the next generation who can build upon our society. Not simply ask, what do you need today? Let me make sure the kid can do it now. So no, oddly enough, the history of public schooling has gotten a very bad rap, and it was never about employees. It was about building informed citizenry so that we can have a republic.
That's nice to hear.
Yeah.
If you were designing a school system today, what would you throw away?
Most tech, one-to-one laptops would be gone. Smartphones would be gone. AI is gone. We would still have a computer lab because sometimes you need tech. If you want to learn about typing, you better have a computer there. If you need to learn about coding, probably better on a computer, but it would be very highly contained. If you wanted to use tech, there'd be a place for it. Just like you have a music room if you want to play the oboe. You want to play basketball, there's the gym. You want to learn tech, there's the tech lab. I would get rid of all, student-facing internet-connected devices would all be gone. And what else would I take away from school? God, I think it's really hard to say because in 2010, back like my last couple of years in the classroom, we were killing it. Schools were doing so dang good. And
really?
People just didn't realize it. If you look at any standardized score take or leave standardized testing, the peak of the NAEP, which is the U.S. standardized test, 2012. The peak of PISA, which is the international standardized test, 2012. Peak of TIMSS, 2010. Peak of PIRLS, 2011. That, we never gotten higher in history than we were doing then. And I think it was because school was pretty damn, we were firing on all cylinders back then. So if you went to school from like mid-90s to about the early teens, you experienced what school was meant to be. And my guess is a lot of people still hated it, but that's welcome to the world. Like, my wife hates school.
Yeah, me too.
She grew up in an independent school in Melbourne, Australia, hates it. So I'm like, you didn't hate school. She goes, yeah, I did. I go, no, you didn't. She goes, prove it. All right. So come to school with me, because all I do is work in schools. I say, come to school with me and watch what happens. And so she goes to class and she's going through school and she's like, this is great. Like, this is fun. Look at the discussions they're having. Look at what they're doing. Why didn't we do this when I was in school? I said, you did. You just don't remember any of that stuff. You hated school because of the social interactions, because you were bullied, because you didn't get along with this teacher, because this teacher was a little more strict than you. All of that stuff made you who you are, but we don't focus on that stuff. We focus on the shit. Adolescence is a very hard time to focus on anything other than the shit. So now she's like, I kind of really think school is good. And I say, yeah, it is. It's a wonderful place. It's just, you got to remember, these kids are growing up. They don't want to be there. They've got a lot on their minds. They got a lot in their hearts. That makes school a very tricky place. They wouldn't be comfortable really anywhere during this stage of life. And so that's what they're going to hold on to. But if we can continue to teach them in an effective way, we can make sure that when they become adults, they might call a few of their teachers and say, thank you. I didn't notice it at the time, but thank you. That really helped me.
Why is it that so many successful people say they succeeded despite school rather than because of it?
Because they're lying to you. No one has succeeded despite school. You think people succeed despite school? Go to any developing nation and tell that story. Doesn't make any sense. The people who say, I don't need school, are the same people who made it into Stanford, who made it into Harvard, who got sirs put before their name. They never succeeded despite school. They only succeeded because of it. They just don't recognize the patterning. Like, it's the reason, the biggest example of this is people say, why do I need to know this? Why do I need to know this? I won't use this in my real life. No, you won't. But if you don't learn that, you will never be able to do the next thing. And then the next thing on top of that. And then the thing on top of that. Eventually, you will be living a life missing the fact that had you not done addition in first grade, you wouldn't be able to do what you're doing right now. But yeah, so you don't use addition in everyday life. But learning is compounding. It's a stepping stone. And if you skip one, you don't get to go to the next one. So yeah, I always kind of laugh. Like when Sir Ken Robinson did his TED talk on schools kill creativity, and I'm not knocking a dead man. I told this to him to his face. I said, oh, it seems to have killed everyone's creativity except for yours. Somehow you managed to give this magical creative talk. Is that in spite of school? Is that we wasted 18 years of your life? Or do you think all of that was foundational to you being able to give that message in a way that resonated with human beings? Whenever anyone says, I never need school, I go, cool, prove it, show me. If you think that's true, would you take your 3-year-old and never put him in daycare? Cool, do it. By all means, would you take your kid and rip him out of primary years? No, go do it. Put your money where your mouth is if you think that's true. And then go ask anyone in a developing nation if that was a good idea. And they'll say, screw you. That's what I gotta say. I was talking about this the other day. We won't talk too deeply about how the brain kind of processes reality, but our stories drive our perception. The stories we use to make sense of the world literally drive what we can see, smell, hear, taste. We like to think the world drives us and then we build stories. Our stories dictate what we do out here and what we actually perceive. Right now, the story around education is that it's boring. It sucks. Kids hate it. I mean, go look at any news story. It's that education sucks. Go look at any popular portrayal of schools in film and in TV. It's kids are bored. They're disengaged. So we have a real engagement problem. You know where there is no engagement problem? Go to any school in Africa. We had an exchange group come from Ghana recently, and all the people were shocked at how disengaged the students were in our school and how misbehaved they were. And they're like, what is going on here? We said, yeah, it's they're teenagers. What are you going to do? And they said, no, that's not what it looks like at our schools. Kids are thrilled to be there because it is an event for them. That is meaningful to them. From the time they're born, they're told education is your ticket to life. And they don't have behavioral problems because the kids are desired to be there. So if you're born, from the time you're born, you're told school sucks. You're gonna hate math. You're gonna be bored. We can't be shocked when we have an engagement problem in school. But if instead, from birth, we tell kids, education is the most important thing in your life. This will give you the knowledge, the insights to actually change the world around you. This will make you a meaningful person. Watch when they become more engaged. It's not magic.
Do you feel like the U.S. is slipping behind other countries?
In terms of
education, in terms of everything that's important.
The U.S. has always been behind other countries in terms of most education. I don't mean to shit on my own country, but compared to European countries, the U.S. has always been kind of lagging, and especially compared to Eastern Asian countries. Whew. But yeah, but I mean, we're just kind of maintaining our position. We're the first to try things, but we're also the first to correct them. Like we were the first nation to really go heavy tech in school, and we are one of the first nations now to really start to pull back. So we're doing things.
Wait,
but
what
we're
do you think
really...
the strengths are of the U.S.?
The U.S. schooling system?
No, U.S. in general, but mainly looking at that.
Freedom is number one here. You have to choose like a K-12 schooling system. I always say go to Australia, go to Italy, go to somewhere in Europe. It's going to be highly structured. You're going to hate it. There's going to be a lot of homework, but my God, you're going to learn a lot. When it comes time to college, go to the U.S. because now we got choice. Everywhere else, when you hit college, when you're 18, you pick your career and that's what you're doing for the rest of your life. Here we recognize, no. Now that you got this knowledge, now that you understand stuff, have a play. From undergrad is basically just drink, take some classes, see what you like. You're going to have a major, but if you want to go to grad school for something totally different, you can. My undergrad was in film. My master's is in neuroscience. How does that work? Because in here we recognize in the U.S., cool, you need time to keep exploring and understanding, and there's freedom to make those moves here. Where other way, as you get into other countries, it's a little more strict once you get to 18 and above.
Yeah, it seems to me like in the U.S., there's more young people are thinking differently. They're thinking with some courage, and maybe they're more not so risk averse, and they're just
no. The U.S. is one of the most risk averse populations, at least childhood, in measurable whatever countries we look at, EU here. By all means, every country is starting to dip on risk acceptability. But no, that's the snowflake problem, is we're not. It looks like we are because kids are dropping out of school fast and they're all going into business. But you got to remember, there's more to life than business. And the only time we ever highlight a kid who's doing anything successful, it's in the business sphere. We never really talk about the kid who planted trees and spent his life there, or the kid who went and helped on a farm, even though those might be more meaningful developmental milestones. But I don't think so. So if... here's one thing people don't recognize. People think knowledge is somehow antithetical to creativity and innovation, right? The more you know, the less creative you're going to be. So it's better to know less stuff and spend more time being creative. That is totally the wrong way to view it. Creativity emerges from knowledge. It is not separate to it. It literally springs from it, which means the more you know, the more creative you will be 100% of the time. So there's a test called the PISA, where I think 63 countries took it last cycle. Hundreds of thousands of ninth graders around 63 countries take the test, math, science, reading. In 2018, they also tested kids on creative ideation, creative application, and innovation. Cool. Now, who do you think nailed the knowledge test? Singapore. Singapore killed everyone on reading, on math, on science. Not shocking, because they're known to have the most rigorous educational system. Guess who beat everyone by a country mile on creativity? No one was even close. Singapore. Singapore destroyed everyone on creativity. And if you line up the country's knowledge score with their creativity score, the two correlated at 0.92. The countries that knew more stuff had more creative kids. So here's where we see creativity isn't something school is blocking us from. The more we learn, the more we stay with it, the more we do the boring, have I read the classics? Have I done this? That's the stuff where creativity comes from. Expertise does not kill creativity. Expertise allows it to thrive, but you gotta take the time to develop the expertise first. There's a reason no Nobel Prize winner has ever been a high schooler. You're too young. It's not that you're stupid or you're dumb. You just don't know enough stuff yet. And because of that, you're always gonna be behind the eight ball compared to people like me. There's another great stat. Sorry, you got me going on some fun stuff here. Track the Nobel Prize age. The age of Nobel Prize winners since the Nobel Prize started has gone up by, I think, 26 years in about eight. So it used to be the average Nobel Prize winner was late 40s, early 50s. Now we're into the late 60s to 70s now. And everyone's like, what's going on? As the world increases, as knowledge increases and fields get bigger, it takes more time to learn the stuff you need to know if you want to then be at the cutting edge. So now it's taking 20 more years to learn enough physics till you can have a breakthrough in physics. And it's going to take the next kid, they have to learn all of that plus your breakthrough before they can make their breakthrough. We can't skip the knowledge phase. And that's what I think a lot of people in the US have tried to do. We can be the creative innovators. Silicon Valley is dead, man. It's gone. LA is starting to die too. All these innovation hubs, you're seeing the death knell. AI is the death knell of US technological brilliance. It's gone. They have no more ideas. We've tapped out. So we're now going to hit this period of decline and we're going to say, what else are we good at? And the answer is going to be taking pictures of each other. I mean, Facebook, TikTok dances, that's what we've dedicated our time to, whereas other countries are now going to soar up and say, well, we've still been doing education. So our kids are going to have a lot more to say and a lot more to do.
Yeah, it seems like public service workers as a whole, but the teachers are so underpaid here.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you got to think, too, who are the two arguably most important groups in this society, teachers and nurses? And who are the two most shit upon groups, teachers and nurses. Mm. They don't get good pay, they don't get respect, and it's an absolute shame. But I think if we can start to recenter teaching and teachers in education, that's never going to be a bad thing.
Has the world changed faster than our schools have?
No. It wants to think it has, but no. Has the world changed faster than a kid learning how to walk? Then no. If the world is still the world and we're still breathing, then you still got to go through the same process to get to a stage where you've got the cognitive juice to actually do anything in this world.
Why do you think anxiety and depression are so prevalent now with young people?
Because the biggest fight against anxiety and depression is connection with other human beings. Have human connections, have connections with place, have connections with culture, society, all those things are how we stave off depression and anxiety. Right now, kids do not have connections with each other. They don't have connections with place. They don't have connections with their school or their community. We were talking about Stolen Focus by Yohan Hari. The second book he wrote was called Lost Connections. And he lays out, here are the seven connections human beings need to thrive. And they're basically all gone. No one has any of them anymore. One of them is connection to work. And that's why I think there was that movement for a while for people to be like, I will only work at a purpose-driven or a meaningful place. But that all kind of collapsed because I think it was more for show than anything else. But I think, I mean, that's it. You gotta actually genuinely connect with your family, with people you love, with people around you. You got to know what's going on. You've got to volunteer to make your community better. Otherwise, we're just chasing dopamine, and that's not the same thing as actual happiness.
And does constant stimulation change the way we experience happiness?
It changes what we chase. The more you get a dopamine hit, it becomes an addiction, and then that's all you're going to seek. But dopamine isn't happiness. Dopamine is just alertness, but we've mistaken the two. So here's kind of how it works. I don't want to bore anyone, but here's a habit cycle. Habits form by something first has to grab your attention. We call those cues. So that could be external or internal. But I think like if your phone dings, that grabs your attention. Cool. If I'm hungry, that grabs my attention. In response to a cue, you can choose to undertake an action to try and resolve it. So if you get a ding and you decide to check your messages on your phone, there's your action. Anytime you undertake an action in response to a cue that resolves it, you will get hit of dopamine. You will feel good. So cue, action, reward. Cue, action, reward. That's how that sets up. Eventually, your brain is not stupid. It's going to preempt you. You do that the same time in the same order enough times, your brain's going to know what's going to happen. Eventually, you're going to get the cue, ding, and your brain's going to say, oh, I know what's coming, and it's going to spit out that dopamine here before you've done an action. When you get dopamine after an action, it feels good. When you get the exact same chemical before the action, it no longer feels good. It feels like a craving. It feels like an urge. Now you have to do the action just to calm your system down and get a sense of relief. So when we move from cue action reward to cue reward action, you've built a habit or an addiction. That's what tech does, is it builds an addiction which forces you to behave in a certain way just to calm your system down. But calming your system down is not the same as thriving. Making sure I don't feel bad is not synonymous with making sure I feel good. And so what happens is as we build more addictions, more habit cycles, we're just constantly chasing homeostasis, normal. It's either we're bad, we're craving, or we're not. We're craving, or we're not. Never do we actually bump into now what we'd call thriving, Bill. That requires connection. And that's the stuff that's much harder to do when cell phones are taking all of our attention.
Mm. Does the human brain need like silence or like time without a cell phone?
We've done it for 150,000 years. So yes, absolutely.
And what happens when we don't get it?
If we don't get a cell phone?
Yeah. No, if we don't get time without away from a cell phone.
Oh, you just keep running habit cycles. They just get worse. So the brain is highly adaptive.
It's probably exhausting too on your eyes or your brain.
Oh gosh. You get hormone problems, you get thyroid problems, you get back problems, you get eye problems. It's all shit. But I mean, it's the same as any other addiction is. As the addiction starts to kick in, your brain will adapt to that to make that addiction normal for you. And now you're going to need a little bit more to get that sensation you once got. And so you're going to push a little harder and then your brain's going to adapt to that. So you're going to allow yourself to push a little bit harder. You're just going to keep pushing in a negative direction until you step away. And so at some point you step away. Now you take away a phone from a kid. Enjoy the next 72 hours. It's going to suck. They're going to fight you tooth and nail. They're going to scream at you. They're going to kick. Same as quitting cigarettes, man. It's going to suck. But you get over that 72-hour hump and you get the system to actually start to self-regulate once again, that's when you'll start to see, okay, I'm getting my kid back. I'm getting my thinking back. I can do this. So by all means, yeah. And the more you do it, but the shitty thing about, and sorry for swearing, but the shitty thing about addictions is, or habits, they're always there. You never lose it. So let's say you go 10 years without ever checking your phone and you're like, this is wonderful. You know what? I've earned a quick check. You go back to your phone, almost instantaneously, the whole system can kick back on. It's not gone.
Back to the same speed you're at too, probably.
Yeah. It can kick you, and that's bad. And it'll get you there fast, which kind of sucks. Mm-hmm. So that's where like AA starts with, I am an addict. I'm not a former drinker. I am an alcoholic. I'm a drinker now. It's the same basic pattern here. So even if you fight it now, we're all stuck in that cycle. So you got to take a lot of willpower, a lot of control to get out of this.
Is loneliness changing our brains?
In this, yeah. And so when we interact with other human beings live and in person, our body will release a chemical called oxytocin, which we call that the bonding chemical. You usually see it when kids are breastfeeding, when you're making love, when you're interacting positively. When we start to feel isolated, our body releases a chemical called tachykinins. Tachykinins are basically a protein peptide that keeps you alert and scared and hyper aroused. So the idea being that the more isolated you feel, your body starts to feel threatened and it kicks you into this kind of higher state. Now, the more lonely you start to feel, you get more tachykinins, you get more depression, the whole cycle kind of feeds itself. So yeah, we can actually track the chemical patterns by which isolation and loneliness are driving biology in a very negative direction.
So obviously we have tons and tons more information than we've ever had in our lives. Is that a good thing or a bad thing for us?
I think a lot of people know the danger of not enough information. If you're misinformed or don't have enough information, that can cause wars, famines, diseases, cool. But very few people recognize the dangers of having too much information. When we have too much information, coherence starts to fracture and fray, and we lose any semblance of connection or meaning. So what I mean is think about schools. One thing schools use is a curricula that organizes thinking and ideas. The curricula was invented in France after the invention of the printing press, because what happened was when the printing press hit, people had so much free access to information that they started to lose any sense of coherence in their society. So school came and said, we're going to build something that says, here's what you need to know. Here's the order you should know it in. If it's not on the curricula, ignore it, please. And it helps us focus on something. So the printing press kicks it off. The next big move then was the telegraph. Now the telegraph not only gives us a lot of information, but it makes it completely disconnected from anything else, freely available as quickly as you need it. So this is when the telegraph comes out, that's when newspapers, you could open a newspaper page and what used to be some sort of coherent writing would now say, there's a war in Israel. There's a boat regatta in Pittsburgh. Here's a picture of a funny dog. Uh-oh, there's a famine. And that's all on the same page, all given the exact same amount of attention. When everything becomes important, nothing becomes important. And again, connection, a sense of understanding starts to fray. So today, when we have all this access to information and it is presented to us as a free-for-all buffet, you can touch anything you want at any moment. There is no connecting through line for it. What you get is a loss of cohesion and people start to become nihilistic. They start to lose any sense of how this world is supposed to be, how they're supposed to fit with it. And this is where you start to see the fracturing of social institutions. Institutions that have always been around to organize thinking and knowledge. The precedence-based court system, medical system, the nuclear family, school, these exist to home in on a very small set of knowledge and say, this is what matters to us. But now that we have so much freely available information, the medical system is fraying as people are just tapping into whatever treatment they want, Dr. Google. The precedent system is fading as every case now has so much information it has to be treated completely individual. The nuclear family, cracking. School, starting to fall apart. This is what happens when we have too much information and we're too afraid to step in and say, no, I'm going to organize it. Here's the way it's supposed to be understood. Here's what you need to know. Don't worry about this stuff. No one wants to pull that trigger anymore because it feels, I don't know, yucky to be the one to say, this matters, this doesn't. But if we don't do that, you're going to have a bunch of kids who believe nothing. Political systems. Political systems existed to organize knowledge. You have to think in a very specific way, otherwise it doesn't work. Now political systems have so many contradictory ideas bleeding in and out. That's the information problem. When you have too much information, too freely available, things become confusing, not coherent.
Mm. If you could redesign childhood from birth to about 18 years old, what would it look like?
And this is going to be totally me. 80s into the 90s, my childhood was freaking wonderful. We didn't have computers yet. They started to come on when we were teenagers. We got our first computer, which meant our childhood was basically open the door at 8 a.m. Your mom would say, I don't want to see you till dinner.
How old are you?
43 now.
43, okay.
Yeah, I'm a while. Born in 82, so that kind of late 80s into the early 90s was just magic. And we wouldn't do it anymore, but it was genuinely, our moms would open the door, say, go. And all the kids around the neighborhood, we'd all collect somewhere, we'd all do stupid stuff, we'd use fireworks, hurt each other. It wasn't safe, it wasn't fun, but that's how we all learned.
That's how you get tough, too.
Yeah, and we became wickedly independent because of that, too.
That doesn't happen anymore.
No. When I was 6 years old, when I was in first grade, I got in trouble at school. I may or may not have thrown a chair through a window. I'm not admitting to it. I never admitted to it then. I ain't going to admit to it now. It may have happened. But they decided to send me home. So they called my mom and my mom said, cool, he can walk home. And they're like, no, you should pick him up. My mom's like, no, he can walk home. First grader, just walking 2 miles home. That's what it used to be. I couldn't imagine a sixth grader today doing anything even close to that. Yeah. I work a lot in schools. When we were growing up, school started and a bunch of buses would come up, let kids out, off you go. If you have a kid in school now, you know the line of cars outside of a school at drop-off time is like a mile long. Every parent has to take their kid to school and then pick them up. Why? This is it. We're not letting them do anything. And the problem is when you don't do anything, when there are no limits, when there's nobody saying no, you lose any sense of aspiration. You have nothing to want to grow into. One of my favorite stats, and I'll butcher the specifics, but when my generation turned 16, over 90% of us started driving at 16. You couldn't stop us. When we hit 16, we were gone. Today, the percentage of kids who are 16 years old in the U.S. driving, I think, is in the 40s. So kids aren't driving. And now the argument is, why? What's going on? And so everyone's like, oh, maybe it's Uber. Maybe public transportation's so good because, yeah, teenagers love taking the bus. No, it's because they've never yearned to drive. When you drive them everywhere their whole life, whenever they need anything, and now they turn 16 and say, do you want to drive? No, you'll drive me. Why would I? You've already done it all for me. But when you've got a 12-year-old and they say, can you drive me to my friend's house? And your parent says, you got feet and you got a bike. Figure it out. But can't you just drive me to the movies? You got feet and you got a bike. Figure out how you're going to make that happen. Of course, when I hit 16, I'm going to drive. That's it. By having rules, by having structure, that is not harming your kid. That is giving them the boundaries within which they can start to bounce their ideas and form an identity. So we have this really weird thing going on in this world right now where we think any rule is like a four-letter word. It's verboten. Don't do it. Without realizing that, no, that is essential for growth. Structure, 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 rules. Being told no is how you fight for a yes. And that's what gives you drive to want to do more.
Do you have hope for the future?
Absolutely. So I published a book on ed tech, so tech in schools, in December, because I wanted to beat the legislation cycle for this year, because I knew three states were going to put ed tech bills together. And I wanted to make sure those states had the data, had the arguments they needed. Cool. So that was December. That was what, 6-7 months ago. Today, there are 31 states at last count with ed tech bills on the docket. Somehow in 6 months, the tech in schools became a very niche topic that a few states were talking about to something that almost every state is now going to have to talk about. I never saw it coming. I would have said 5 to 10 years before we got to that stage. But it happened so fast that, yeah, it really gives me hope to say, okay, people are going to pay attention. We can push back against this. And it's the smartphones, people starting to ban that. Yeah, it all looks like we're willing to say our bad. We tried an experiment. We did it for a couple decades. We do not like the outcome, and we are willing to now start to go back. Will we lose money because big tech won't pay us anymore? Maybe. But I think we're doing better by our kids, and people want that. You know what's kind of – this is going to sound very weird. You know what my barometer for hope is? The SpaceX stock. Every cent that thing drops gives me more hope for humanity. Every cent it goes up scares me that maybe we didn't learn our lesson yet. Because if you think about it, and I'm not trying to knock anyone here, but what is that? It's the highest valued thing that's just, it's so outlandish. And their arguments are, we're going to do things that I, as a scientist, I promise you, you will never do. Not in my lifetime, not in my kid's lifetime, probably not for another 250 years. We're going to colonize Mars. Mate, we haven't even gotten out of our atmosphere in the last
year. Sure, drive across the country sometime and tell me why you're colonizing Mars.
We got space. I just
drove across the country a couple months ago. There's nobody living between like Arizona and Tennessee.
But we need Mars. For what the hell are you talking about? We need tunnels that are going to connect our cities. You mean trains? We have that. It's okay. We don't need new, like, we're going to build a data center on Mars. You can't even build a data center over here successfully. What the fuck are you going to build it in the sky for? SpaceX is like the perfect example of, I'm going to weave a story and you're going to buy that story come hell or high water. And that's been really the last 20 years of big tech. Tech hasn't really had any new scalable ideas since the iPhone. It's just cycling the same basic crap. But what they're doing is weaving stories that make me go, woo, yeah, let me give you more money for this. SpaceX comes out, it is the biggest example of nothingness wrapped as something. And so if that stock drops, that's a sign to me that, yeah, we're catching on. People are saying, no, enough of this stuff. Stop. Show me something. I don't want a promise. I want an actuality. A future world of beauty is irrelevant. I need a current understanding of what it is you're using my money to do or what you're trying to achieve in this world. So every time, that's kind of been my barometer, and it's been going down, down, down. I think we've hit 8 days in a row now. It's gone down. That means to me we're catching up. The normal people are starting to fight back and say, cut this crap out. Let's go back to what works. hang out with our kids, have a job that pays me enough money so that I can live somewhere and actually spend time with my kids, have my kids read, have my kids do math, maybe a little less video gaming, maybe a little bit more swinging on a swing at the playground. We're getting back to something normal again.
Wouldn't it be great if one of these younger generations figured this all out and kind of steered us all in a totally different direction?
I always tell, whenever I have to work with students, one of the things I say is my biggest hope is exactly that, is that you are going to wake up in 10 years and realize you're struggling because of what we did to you, that none of this is your fault, that we fucked up. You never asked me to put a screen in front of your face for 18 years, but I did it all the same. And when you get mad, then you push back. And you will be the ones to fix all of the mess we made. That you'll say, you know what? Not my kids. You taught me with a screen. I ain't teaching my kid with a screen. We're going to do something different. That's my hope.
And you have a young child.
3 years old.
Yep. 3 years old. Congratulations. What do you look forward to teaching your kid?
It's funny. Before you have a kid, I have all these grandiose visions. With a kid, I'm basically just interested in getting through the day with her. It's so funny.
Oh, that's what the kids want and need.
That's it.
Just
be there.
Interacting with a parent.
Yep. And it's
and knowing that that parent wants to spend time with the kid.
And it's tricky,
like,
too.
Like quality time.
Because we're addicted to tech, too. So every 10 minutes, your brain is pulled to, I should be doing an email right now. I should be looking at this feed right now. And you've got to really, it's not easy, but you got to force yourself to say, what could be more important than building this Lego tower with my daughter? Is it thrilling? Maybe not. But if you really just let yourself get into it, yeah, you get there. And so what do I want to teach her? I don't know. I'm like the king of, she doesn't scare me. Nothing about her scares me. So I'm not worried about her. I love when she starts to read, so I can start teaching her letters. She just doesn't give a shit at this point. She's much more into it.
But by spending time with your kid, that's how you teach them to love themselves.
Yeah. And that's what,
because if you're spending time with them, that means they're worthy and it means they can love themselves easily.
And they don't have to fight for attention. They don't have to fight for you. And I think, so you might like this, is we're moving to Italy in December and we're sending her to a nature school. There are a few here that are just really hard to lock into. There, they're pretty common. And the idea is basically you've got some classroom time, I guess, in the morning, sing songs.
Only kids would eat that shit up.
And that's it. The rest of the day, go outside. Just go.
You look forward to school every day that way.
That's what we're hoping. And people say, well, how is she going to learn to read? Like, cool, we got it. She's going to be fine. We have this love affair with speed and development. It's like, my kid is in third grade, but reads at a sixth grade level. How about yours? I'm like, my kid will read at a sixth grade level. When they're in sixth grade, what's the fucking rush? they don't need a job tomorrow. We have standards for a reason. I don't need to push her in any way, shape, or form. So I just love just watching her do her thing. And she's really getting into, I didn't know that this was a thing, but it is three-nager. Have you heard of that?
No.
So you experienced this with your daughters. Whew, 3 years old is a weird age. She is getting independent. She's figuring out what independence means, which means, by definition, me and my wife have to be the bad guy. We are the heavy. If she decides she needs a moment of independence, we are the ones stopping her from that. So we are now in trouble. And so it's very similar to how teenagers will push back against their parents when they need their identity. And yeah, so it's never saw that coming, never, but you just got to learn to roll with the punches.
Being a parent's an adventure.
I'll tell you. But what could be better? I always say, look, my brother said something funny. He said, kids will be the bane of your existence, but the center of your universe, the joy of everything. And that's it. I mean, nothing is harder. Nothing is easier. Nothing is worse. Nothing is better. It's just every extreme wrapped up in a little person. And I got so sick of me. I know me. I'm stuck in this damn head all day, every day. Having someone else that you can actually devote your time and effort to that says, this isn't me, this is you. It's so fulfilling. It's so much nicer.
Yeah, that's a great sign of a healthy human being.
I don't know. I'll try my best.
You know, you seem to be doing a great job.
If we can raise, if she grows up well, then I'll say I did my job.
Jared, let me ask you one last question. What would you say is the most important lesson you've learned in your life?
This is going to sound bad. Most important lesson I ever learned in my life. This is going to sound bad. I promise you it's not. No one is going to do shit for you. I have learned that no matter what level you're shooting at, people are very happy to ride your coattails, but very few people are willing to open doors for you. You've got to do it yourself. So I'm like the king of, when I teach at university and some kids come in, the first thing I'll tell them is, you're going to wait for us to tell you what to do. Don't. You now have 3 years to figure out what you want to do. Open every door. Go knock on every door you see here. Join classes you otherwise wouldn't have joined. If you want to make a movie, make a movie. Figure it out. Do it. Because we keep waiting for the world to help us. In my experience, it doesn't really happen. I get a lot of love from my family. I get a lot of support. But when it comes time to do something, buckle down, do it yourself.
Mm. Amazing talk. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. I love it. By the way, you're a perfect example of it. Is you don't get 12,000 interviews by waiting for the world to come to you. You just decide, you know what? We're going to set up. We're going to do this. Let's fucking do it.
7 years ago, I was sitting on my ass like, what am I going to do? Because I got out of my advertising career and I just sat here and like, what do I do now? What am I doing? Oh, let me do something I'm really into. And I just decided this was it and I've just never stopped.
And grow. You know who, did you ever hear, there's a group called Lonely Planet. It's Andy Samberg, Akiva. It's like three.
Yeah, I think I've seen it.
What I love about them is everything they do, they've just done by themselves. And it's like how haven't you hit the big time? Like, why aren't you getting $150 million contracts to do X-Men? And they're like, we don't know, but we just keep doing it ourselves. Just keep chugging along.
Yeah, and if it's meant to be, you'll be discovered. And if it isn't, you'll have a great time. And
you will regardless. Have done what you wanted to do. Mm-hmm. You never waited for the world to give you the okay or the green light. You just fucking did it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think listening to yourself, thinking for yourself, is probably the most important thing you teach our kids to do.
Yeah. Oh, I agree with that 100%. And how do you do it, too? Thinking through knowledge. That's where the modern progressive movement in school, where they don't need to know stuff because they have access to stuff, scares the shit out of me, because it's like, well, no, you need, if you want to think for yourself, you better have a lot to think with. Otherwise, you're going to be very underinformed, and thinking for yourself is going to be geared to whoever gave you that idea. And that's what you see a lot, is a kid will see something on Facebook and then spout that out as though that's their opinion, because that's the only thing they know. Whereas, and that's fine. I think we all did that at some stage, but the joke is you now need to get 10 different opinions, fight them all, and then decide what it is for yourself. And so that only comes through knowledge and time and space to think.
To oversimplify everything, it seems like a lot of us we're in two categories, basically, to oversimplify. We're either leaders or we're followers.
Yeah.
And to teach your kid how to be a leader, how to think for himself, how to just get things done without the help of some mom or dad or somebody who's going to, you know, sponsor you,
yeah,
is the key. And if you can do that, then you can do anything.
And it is easy.
You can change careers. You can transition. You can reinvent yourself.
And I love it. And that's why I always, it's not easy. It's never, it's always, you have to do shit you don't feel comfortable doing, but.
That's exciting.
What else is there? That's it.
That's what makes life exciting.
And I'll tell you, the best leaders are the ones that are just doing their life. There's nothing I dislike more than the boss of the leader who's like, I trained to be a leader. Fuck you. No, you didn't. You can't train to be a leader. People will follow people who are just doing, who are doing their passion. And that's why a lot of the best leaders are like, I don't want to be a leader. I just want to get work done. I want to make something happen.
Yeah, there's a little bit too much focus on getting attention.
Mm.
Or getting acclaim or getting
fame. There was a school in Australia I worked at where the principal changed everything up and made it a free-for-all. There's no more classes. There's no more year levels. Everyone do whatever you want to do. And over 2 years, their scores started to go up. So he left the school and started doing TED Talks. And now he's famous and he writes books and makes millions of dollars. Meanwhile, I go back to his school. Oh, year three, the year he left, they tanked. They bottomed out. 60% of the teachers left. Like, we don't know what we're doing. This is a horrible system. What's happening here? And it was never about building a good school. It was about building a name. And when people themselves became brands, that's embarrassing. You're not a brand. I got to sell my brand. I got to be known as the crazy principal. No, just do good work. You do good work like night follows day. People will follow. People will understand. They'll hear it. They'll start to adopt it. But if you just go for fame, who cares?
Yeah, social media has created all these altered versions of humans that never really existed before. These super attention hungry, I don't know, I'm not going to use the term, but it's like they're just, it's not a healthy way for a human to go about life.
It's the narcissist problem. So narcissism, the myth of Narcissus. Everyone thinks Narcissus falls in love with himself and that it's a story about pride. No, Narcissus falls in love with his reflection. It's a story about the dangers of externalizing your identity, of falling for who the world shows you you are, rather than deeply understanding yourself who you are. So when we say kids today are more narcissistic than ever before, we're not saying they love themselves more. We're saying they're farming their identity out more to this point now where you have human beings who do not exist outside of what the world tells them they are. They might write a song, put it online, and it's neither good nor bad to them until they see how many likes it got. This one got 100 likes, must be a good song. That only got 10, oh, it's a shitty song. At no point do they stop and think, who am I? What am I supposed to do? And that is driven 100% by this fame-seeking, attention-seeking monster of social media.
Every generation has had their hurdles and struggles and obstacles that, you know, whether it's war or whether it's the depression or whatever's been going on, there's always been these problems and these opportunities.
Yeah.
Do you think the problems and hurdles that they have now are any more daunting than the ones that other generations had?
Yes, in the sense that every hurdle we've had in the past has at some level helped us develop. The hurdles they are facing now are stopping or fragmenting their development. That's what they're designed to do. A war makes you grow up pretty damn fast. A divorce makes you grow up pretty damn fast. A video game makes you stop growing up. Social media makes you stop figuring out what matters to you. So yeah, I think the hurdles now might be easier seeming than things we've seen in the past, but they're acting as roadblocks rather than guideposts or signposts to help people develop. And that's, I mean, go back to, how does Narcissus end? He kills himself. And I think the point of that is when Narcissus realizes I am not that, I am this, rather than going through the daunting process of now figuring out who am I, he just says, screw it, I'm just going to off myself. That's too hard. And that's what I fear a lot of kids are going to do. They're going to hit their 30s and 40s and realize they don't have any actual idea of what they value, what they desire, what they want. And that's going to be a real scary moment for them. And they're going to have to make their decision. Do I now go through the process of self-discovery, or do I just keep going down this pipe of put out more content and see what the hell people think? Oh, that was good. That was bad. And it does. It scares me. But I think Gen Alpha is really pushing back against it. If they don't like AI, that's a good sign they won't like social media very much. So
yeah,
bright signs ahead, thank goodness.
It'd be so cool if we decide 1 month a year we're just going to not use technology.
There's a group in Spain led by a guy named Diego. I forget his last name, but it's called Off January or Off February.
And that's, I think it's February, yeah.
That's their big move is let's 1 month just off. Can you do it? And do it with your family. Get people. Do it as a group. Don't try and do it yourself. Do it together. Support each other. What an awesome. If you get that kind of worldwide, what an awesome endeavor that would be.
That would be one of the most fascinating experiments ever.
Yeah. And if it's just, say, under 18, because I could see some people at work being like, I can't be off. Cool. Under 18. You as adults, if you're at work, fine. But in your household?
No, not under 18. Like everybody.
I would love that.
All of us.
I would love that.
Every last one of us.
Oh, but how would I write if I don't have my keyboard? You got to go back to a pen and paper. Oh, I love it. Then you got to go back to – that was always my favorite thing. At universities, you would go to the library and they'd have all the journals and you had to search the journals. And in so doing, you'd find 10 articles you didn't even know existed.
Go to the library now. They're empty.
That's – now you just type what you want. There it is. I'm like, oh, but all that – that was the discovery is you came across this article. You're like, what the hell is this? I didn't even know that was a thing. I need that. Oh, what's this one? It was – that discovery's just gone because it's too easy to say just this now. So – but if we got rid of tech for a month, I'd have to go back to journals. I'd love it, man. I would love it.
That'd be cool. All right. Jared Cooney Horvath, thank you so much, man. What a fascinating talk.
No, thank you. It's been great.
Yeah, we'll do another one one day.
I'd love to.
Thanks,
absolutely,
man.
Dude, that was – thank you so much.